Welcome back. We now go to the Wednesday press conference at the Department of State with State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert.
Good afternoon. How is everybody?
Freezing.
Well, it will keep you awake.
It's so cold in here.
You know what?
We could store meat and ice cream.
That's right, we could. But I do remember one time last summer, it was so warm in here that some of you, I won't name who, were dozing off in the front row. So keeping it cool keeps you awake.
It must be somebody who's already just there.
Yeah. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm not going to say who it was. A couple announcements to bring in, starting out with a very serious topic, and that is the suicide attack that took place in Afghanistan. The United States government strongly condemns and is appalled by today's suicide attack at an education center in a community in Kabul that killed 48 innocent civilians and injured many more. We send our deepest condolences to the families of those who were affected and their friends, and wish for a speedy recovery for those who were wounded. The horrific attack is a clear effort to foment sectarian violence and hold back the Afghan people's hopes for a future of peace and security. It reminds us once again the importance of reaching a peaceful solution to the conflict in Afghanistan. The United States continues to stand with the government of Afghanistan and the people of Afghanistan, and will continue to support their efforts to achieve peace and security in their country. Next, I'd like to mention something related to Iran, and I know many of you have watched this with great interest, the continued human rights abuses in that country. We are closely monitoring reports of numerous human rights defenders and members of minority groups, such as the Ghanabadi dervishes, who are unlawfully or arbitrarily incarcerated in Iranian regime prisons. Yesterday, I tweeted about Narges Mohammadi. She's a mother of two with a critical health condition, who was recently sentenced to a total of 16 years in prison for peacefully advocating for human rights reforms. Today, we are especially concerned about a prominent human rights lawyer named Nasin Sotoudeh, who has been detained in Tehran's Evin prison since June 2018, and who is facing national security charges for legally representing an Iranian woman who was charged for removing her headscarf in public. The Iranian regime jails people for peacefully exercising their rights and then jails people who are asked to defend them. These daily human rights violations and arbitrary arrests are simply unacceptable. We call on our partners around the world to join us in urging the Iranian regime to stop persecuting its people for exercising their human rights and their fundamental freedoms. And last, I'd like to address something that has taken place recently in Cambodia. And as many of you are aware, and we've discussed here, their recent elections, which the State Department has characterized as flawed and neither free nor fair. As previewed in the White House's July 29th statement on Cambodia's election, we are expanding the visa restrictions initiated on December 6, 2017, on individuals involved in the undermining of democracy in Cambodia. The expanded entry restrictions may apply to individuals both within and outside the Cambodian government who are responsible for the most notable anti-democratic actions taken in the run-up to the flawed July 29th election. In certain circumstances, their immediate family members will also be subject to restrictions. We reiterate our call for the Cambodian government to take tangible actions to promote national reconciliation by allowing independent media and civil society organizations to fulfill their vital roles unhindered, and immediately release Kem Sokha and other political prisoners, and ending the ban on political opposition. With that, I'd be happy to take your questions. Oh, but I do have one more announcement. I'd like to say happy birthday to Elise Lavitt from CNN. Happy birthday, Elise. She's off, as she should be today. Okay.
Yes. Happy birthday to Elise, indeed. Just on Cambodia real quick.
Yes.
When you say you're expanding the visa restrictions, expanding from how many to how many?
I don't have the numbers before me on that, but they're reviewed, obviously, on a case-by-case basis.
How do we know, then, they're actually being expanded?
They're being expanded in, well, because the secretary has a broad authority under the Immigration and Naturalization Act to restrict the visas of those who want to come into the United States that would have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences. And so the laws are confidential, as you well know, the visa laws are. So we're not going to be able to release a list of those who will fall under this.
Okay. I'm not asking for a list, yeah. But I mean, what does it mean to expand them? If you can't say with a number that you started with and now mm-hmm. the number that they're going to be, I mean, I don't know how you can say you're expanding them.
Well, we are expanding that. I will see if our consular people
Does
can get you additional
a new
information
category
on that.
Category of people.
Pardon
now?
Me.
Does it include a new category of official?
It's a way that we can review who is coming in and applying for visas and provide and make a determination as to who can come into the United States and who cannot.
I know, but this is the problem with these kinds of things. Yeah. It happens with Nicaragua. It happens. With, mm-hmm. You say that you're doing this, and then we the public. And the Cambodians themselves have mm-hmm. no idea what actually this means. If we don't know, it's expanding the scope of the category of people who can be who will be excluded or will be denied visas, or is it just a number?
Matt, I will see what additional what additional information I can get you if we can provide you numbers on that.
On Turkey, mm-hmm. you may have seen today that the guy who was the honorary chairman of Amnesty International, mm-hmm. Who had been in jail there, was released today.
Right, and I believe we've provided statements about that case in the past. Certainly.
Yeah, and but I'm sure you've seen that a judge denied Pastor Brunson's appeal.
I have.
And I'm also sure that you've seen the tariff announcement from the Turkish government. So I'm just wondering what you have to say about all three of those.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's start first with Pastor Brunson. Of course, we are very aware of the decision on the part of the court in Turkey. We're certainly disappointed by that announcement. We would like Pastor Brunson to be brought home to the United States. We have said for far too long that Pastor Brunson has been held for far too long, and we look forward to Pastor Brunson coming home. We'd like that to happen very soon.
Okay. And the other two?
Sure, go right ahead. The second one was about what again?
Well, I mean the Amnesty International and the tariffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean we're
and
certainly.
Also, and then on Brunson or on the tariffs, which I guess your White House colleague made a point to separate, saying that the U.S. tariffs that were imposed did not have anything to do with the mm-hmm. Brunson case, but that the sanctions on the two officials. Do justice or the
yeah so in terms of the yeah. Amnesty International person, we're certainly pleased that he has been released. We have put out statements in the past on his case, and for that matter the case of many others we've seen as the Turkish government has detained people, many of them journalists, activists, members of civil society, accusing them or putting them in prison on what many would regard as trumped-up charges. So we're pleased that that they made that announcement today. In terms of Turkey and tariffs and our overall relationship with Turkey, I'm not going to characterize the extent of our relationship with Turkey. I mean, there's clearly work that is left to be done. The diplomacy continues. I anticipate that we will be talking with the Turkish government at some point in the future about the case of Pastor Brunson and the case of other Americans.
Are you aware of anything scheduled or anything ongoing?
No, we have nothing scheduled. No meetings or calls or anything of that sort to announce. Leslie, go right ahead.
So is the administration, or do you know, given what happened today with Pastor Brunson, given the tariffs, is the administration considering any retaliation?
Leslie, you know, we don't get ahead of sanctions. We don't forecast sanctions. I don't know personally what is going to happen in the future, but those are things that are always, as a general matter, things that the U.S. government is able to deploy.
The vice president just tweeted that, you know, saying he's demanding his release. I mean, has the secretary made that message clear to East Turkish counterparts?
I think we've discussed this before, that the U.S. government, whether it's the vice president, the president, the secretary, we've made our expectations very clear. We want our people home.
Just now the White House said that the U.S. is prepared to bring sanctions against Turkey until Brunson is free.
Okay, I've not seen that, so I'm not going to comment on that.
Well, I mean, I'm just telling you so that I can ask the questions. Mm-hmm. But given that that has been sort of the policy so far, along with diplomacy, it's obvious it's not working. So why continue down that path? And is there something else that you feel the State Department can do or work on to change the course?
Well, look, I think what we do here is we talk with other countries, and that is something that the State Department just simply does. So we will continue our diplomatic approach, and you would characterize it as it's not working. We don't have Pastor Brunson home yet. We don't have other Americans home yet, but we will keep working on it. It doesn't mean that we're going to stop trying. Okay? Saeed, go right ahead.
The fact that Qatar is infusing $15 billion to shore up, apparently, to shore up the Turkish lira.
I saw that report. I just have to refer you to the government of Qatar and the government of Turkey. I don't have any comment for you on that. I'd have to refer you to those governments. Pardon me?
Do you welcome the step that Qatar has made?
I think that's between those two countries, and I'm not going to comment on that, so I just refer you to those governments on that issue. Hi, Nick.
Just following up on Turkey, can you say what the last time was there was actually a discussion between whoever it is who's handling the Runcan case with the Turkish government?
As you know, Ambassador Bolton, National Security Advisor Bolton, spoke with the Turkish ambassador 2 days ago, Monday this week here in Washington. I believe that was the last conversation. But I certainly can't rule out that our embassy or other State Department personnel or U.S. government personnel would not have talked to Turkish officials about other matters.
But is it your policy right now that there will be no discussion about this issue until he's released?
We don't have any policy on that I'm aware of.
Why is it important, this one American, to put global financial stability at risk, put U.S. base presence in Turkey at risk, put a NATO ally, an alliance with a NATO partner at risk for one American who's being put through the Turkish justice
system? So you're saying this is our fault? This situation is our fault?
Why escalate it to that level for a single American who's not been tortured or
I would take issue with the premise of your question. In terms of the financial situation in Turkey, we addressed this yesterday. And Turkey's financial situation has been in the works for quite some time. And it dates prior to the imposition of sanctions on August the 1st. So this has been in train for quite some time, and you cannot blame the U.S. government for that. We have a very broad relationship with the government of Turkey. Of course, with all nations, as a general matter, we will often have areas where we don't always agree, where we don't always see eye to eye, but we also have areas where we do work together and cooperate, and Turkey would be one of those governments where we sometimes have areas where we disagree, and we certainly sometimes have areas where we cooperate as well.
But this isn't one thing that you simply disagree one area. This has been put to the forefront of everything.
And your question is?
So why is this one more important than all the others, it seems?
You're trying to single out one individual. And I have stood here repeatedly, as have many of my colleagues, to speak about other people who have been detained in that country. Our chief mission is the protection of American citizens. That would obviously include Pastor Brunson. We also have three locally employed staff. I spoke about them just yesterday and was very clear with all of you that is a major concern of ours. There's also a NASA scientist who has been detained by the Turkish government. That is important to us as well. And you've heard that come out of the State Department. You've heard that come out of the White House and from our other colleagues as well. Okay, Lori, go ahead.
Senator K. Pompeo spoke with the KRG and Iraqi prime ministers yesterday, and I saw your readout on that. Was there a particular reason now for his call and the presumed concern that would have prompted the call?
No, we have those calls, as just a matter of diplomacy, have those calls regularly with other governments and other officials, and I think it was just a matter of checking in.
Okay. On Turkey and Russia, the Russian foreign minister was just in Turkey to prepare for a summit on Syria that's going to take place in Turkey in September and which will include France and Germany. Are you invited to that summit? Mm-hmm. And if not, what's your view of the meeting? Is it replacing Geneva?
No, nothing is replacing Geneva. And I think this is another example and another reason for us to reaffirm our commitment to the Geneva process. We see the Geneva process, the UN-led process, is the only viable way forward for a long-term political solution in Syria. I can tell you that the secretary met earlier today with Stefan de Mistura, who's running that Geneva process. A readout is in train right now. I hope to have that to all of you within short order. But that just goes back to our commitment to Geneva and many other countries that have committed to the Geneva process. Russia, in fact, was one of them that had committed to the Geneva process. So we stand firmly behind that and the work of Stefan de Mistura and the United Nations in that.
Will you be at the summit in Turkey in September?
Well, who?
So will the United States be attending this summit?
I am not aware of any participation in that. If that changes, I will certainly let you know. Hi, Michelle.
The Geneva process is frozen, and nobody is talking about it. There is no meetings. There is nothing. And what's the...
I'm talking about it. And there are a lot of other countries, including the United States, that have backed the Geneva process and continue to back the Geneva process. The reality is that that is the only viable solution going forward. You have these sidebar meetings, things like Astana and other things, okay, but the best one, the best way forward that the United States believes in, that the United Nations and many other countries believe in, is the Geneva process. Perhaps that process needs to be goosed again, but I think you'll be hearing in the coming days that that is something that we are doubling down our efforts and supporting that process going forward. Hey, Abby.
Hey. Staying in that area, there was a UN report that came out this week saying that around 20,000 to 30,000 ISIS fighters still remain in Iraq and Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an assessment that the U.S. shares? And if so, what do you see as the timeline in the U.S. staying in Syria, considering...
Okay, so you know we never talk about timelines. Well, yeah. Those things are all conditions-based, and we certainly have a lot of work that is left to be done in Syria. Our role and mission in Syria is in dealing with ISIS. We remain committed to that. We have a lot of U.S. service members who are working very hard there, along with our diplomats and our folks on the ground from the State Department, who are helping out in Syria as well. So we anticipate, you know, we will certainly be there and continue to support efforts there. In terms of your question about the number of ISIS fighters, I've seen various numbers. I think those numbers are hard to really pin down those numbers because of the complex nature of Syria and the difficulty that people would have in actually counting things, getting good information from the ground. So I don't have a U.S. government estimate to provide for you. Perhaps another department or agency has additional figures that they could provide, but I can't verify those numbers. The estimates that we've seen vary a lot.
I have one follow-up
sure.
on that. One of the things that the president said in April is that he thought the coalition was close to retaking 100% of the territory that had been held by ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's 20,000 to 30,000 ISIS fighters that still remain in Iraq and Syria, where is it that, what is the U.S. doing to prevent them from leaving the area, and is there concern, considering what's happening in Turkey right now, that they may be going across the border into other countries?
I haven't seen any reports about Turkey, and a lot of this would be best addressed by the Department of Defense, so I don't want to get into their lane and would really hesitate doing that. But in the past, I can speak generally about how there have been pockets of ISIS fighters in very difficult areas. You remember how long it took, we talked about this last summer, how long it took to get ISIS fighters out of Mosul and liberate Mosul, especially West Mosul and the western part of that city from ISIS. This is tough work. We have consistently said that we know that this is going to take quite some time. We know that this process is not going to be easy. You have some successes, and then sometimes things backtrack, and then you have successes again. So I think it just goes to show that this is a long fight. We continue to be committed to this fight, and we're not backing down from that. ISIS needs to be defeated, and the U.S. government will stand firmly by that. Okay. Hi, Cindy.
I know we touched on this yesterday about the risk of economic fallout from the worsening Turkey dispute.
Mm-hmm.
Are there conversations going on to try to mitigate sort of the risk of market contagion?
I think that would be for another department to address that. But I'll go back and say this one more time. The financial situation in Turkey had been in train, in process, prior to the imposition of sanctions on the part of the United States government. Okay. Hey. Hi.
Just to follow up on your statement at the top of the briefing, in addition to the attack that you mentioned, there was a Taliban siege started over the weekend on Ghazni.
Yep.
And there's been a lot of violence in the last week or so. We're coming up now on a year of the president's launch of the South Asia strategy. Is it time to maybe reevaluate that strategy?
No, it's not. I think what we're seeing here is... there are some factions, some elements of the Taliban that clearly are not on board with peace. Others do want to have peace negotiations and peace discussions. Those who don't support peace, I think we are seeing them act out at this time. And that does not dissuade us from our commitment to Afghanistan or our commitment to the overall Afghan-led, Afghan-owned peace process. We've seen approximately three attacks take place, and I think just as many days, two attacks on military outposts and the attack that I just mentioned at the top of the briefing today on the education center. They're appalling. They are appalling attacks, but we remain firmly committed to working with the government of Afghanistan for an Afghan-led, Afghan-owned peace process. The Afghan people deserve better. We had seen some glimmers of hope in the past with ceasefires that have been successful, granted for a relatively short period of time. But that is something that President Ghani has supported. And he says that they will, continue to try to pursue peace. And we firmly support him in that effort. And let me just add that we want to offer our deepest condolences to the Afghan people for what they've experienced over the last several days. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Go right ahead.
Have you seen any sustained interest from fact? You said some factions of the Taliban, but...
Well, I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, it's just evident what's going on.
In peace talks with the United States?
No. It is evident that some are not supportive of peace because we see some attacks taking place.
But okay. is the inverse then true? Is there sustained interest by factions in talking to the United States? Have there been renewed talks?
I have no information for you on that. I can only tell you that in our past conversations with President Ghani and the government of Afghanistan, that we continue to support their peace efforts. Hi, Saeed.
Sure. On Israel, on Israel, increasingly the Israeli authorities are holding, interrogating American scholars. You know, Peter Beinart being one, Reza Aslan being another. Last week was a woman named Zimmerman. A month before, scholars from Columbia and so on. I wonder if you have anything to say about the holding, apparently without a reason, of these American scholars. I mean, to say nothing of what they do with the Palestinian Americans.
Yeah. So, Saeed, this is something that we talk about time and time again, how much the United States values a freedom of expression. And that includes a freedom of expression from those that we don't always agree with. Some of you, some days, for example. We don't always agree on issues and policies and debates, and we can have disagreements. But that is something that we continue to support. As you bring up American citizens, you know we take our obligation and our duty to assist U.S. citizens extremely seriously. In terms of specific reports, I can't comment on what has happened to specific Americans or conversations that they have had with the government. I believe that the Israeli government has addressed some of these recent situations in recent days, and so I just have to refer you to the government of Israel for more on that.
And Israel just announced that the ceasefire has been implemented between Israel and Hamas. You have any comment?
I'm not aware of that. I had not seen that report. My apologies. Abby, go right ahead.
On Bangladesh.
Okay.
Switch. Do you have any comment, or does State Department have any concern over the crackdown on student protesters, the arrests that have been happening within Bangladesh?
So this is a story that was in the news largely a week ago or so, and we're certainly aware of what started some of these protests. And there was a situation in which two young children were killed by a speeding bus. I think that's what you're talking about. And protests started where young people were standing up and saying, people need to be drive more safely here in Bangladesh. And that kind of increased. Those protests started to increase. The government took some measures, I think, to try to limit some of those protests. I don't have any new details for you on what may or may have happened in the last day or so. I just don't have that fresh of information. But I know that we have a good relationship with the government of Bangladesh. We make our concerns about many matters very clear to that government, and we continue to have good cooperation with them. But we also, as we just discussed with Saeed, support the freedom of speech and the right to protest peacefully. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, thank you very much. North Korea. South Korean government will paying $8 million to North Korea for the humanitarian assistance. Is humanitarian assistance is the including the sanctions against North Korea? What is your
Jenny? I don't have any information on this recent report. So if you can get me some additional information, I can try to get you an answer on that.
Thank you.
Okay. Hey, Callie.
So on Myanmar, we've seen Politico had a story about how there was a something on what the secretary may or may not say regarding the situation with the Rohingya. Do you have anything to announce on, is the State Department going to call it genocide? What's been happening in Rakhine State with the Rohingya?
Mm-hmm. First let me start by saying, I'm certainly familiar with that report that came out. The report that came out revealed documents that were internal deliberative documents from the State Department. Someone at the State Department or in one of the agencies leaked those documents to a reporter. And I just want to say that I had conversations with the secretary about this, and we have had conversations internally about that matter. And it's a real disappointment, I want to say, when colleagues, professionals leak deliberative documents. And you know why? Because it harms our ability to make decisions, to have free conversations among our colleagues about certain issues in the news, certain things that we need to make very important decisions about. In addition, when documents like that leak, it can also lead to people being injured in the field. And I don't just mean Americans, but I mean people on the ground. And so that remains a very serious and real concern of ours. And some folks out there may not think that that is a big deal. But when governments know that we're having a deliberative process about how to label something, what to call something, that can cause other countries, and I say this as a general matter, to act out and do certain things that we wouldn't want them to do. So I want to highlight while we're here the seriousness of leaking documents and the grave concern that we have, the State Department has, over when those kinds of things happen. As for any decision, the Secretary, to my awareness, has not made any particular decision yet, but if and when he does, we'll certainly let you know and make that public.
Okay. Are you trying to say that the American people do not have a right or a reason to expect to know the deliberative process of their own government, the people who they pay to act
the deliberative names? The deliberative process is something that is supposed to be maintained discreetly and handled here within the confines of the State Department and not to be shared with a group of reporters or the general public. That is the deliberative process. Now, the final product, absolutely, absolutely. But people should have the right in here at the State Department, whether it's the top person or whether it's one of the most junior people, to have conversations and to be able to have debates about decisions that individuals want to make and our policy decisions here.
That's understandable, mm-hmm. but the deliberative process of the U.S. government is news, mm-hmm. okay?
It's news when it leaks, and it is a concern of this department when people make the decision to leak documents.
Every single administration, as long as leaks mm-hmm. have existed, mm-hmm. which go back a long time, mm-hmm. has always complained about leaks.
And you know what? You know why that's a concern, Matt? Why that's a concern? Because it limits our ability to have internal conversations. You don't work here. I do. I've seen it. I've seen it firsthand. It can also hurt people who are in the field. These things have real life implications. And sometimes, I love working with you all, but sometimes reporters fail to understand just how sensitive and serious these things can be.
I've been doing this a long time. Yeah. You point to me one line or anything in that mm-hmm. story that you're talking about that endangers someone in the field. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
You and I can talk about this offline. I would be happy to.
You brought it up publicly and said the publication of this endangers people's lives.
Yeah, it can. I said it can.
I want to know.
It certainly can. And you know what? I'm not going to say any more about that because it can. Listen, I'm not going to get into details about that because that could further endanger people's lives. And I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. Anyone wants to have an off-the-record conversation, I'd be more than happy to right after this briefing.
I would also point out that I don't think there's any evidence that these documents coming out or whatever or any leak has hindered or limited internal deliberation. Mm-hmm. You would like to say that, but I don't think that's true.
That's your opinion. And once you work for the government, I think you would recognize and realize just how important those conversations are. And I'm going to have to wrap it up in just a minute. Go ahead. Ben, go right ahead.
Yeah, on Taiwan, are any State Department officials planning on meeting President Tsai when she comes back through the U.S.?
Not to my knowledge, and I'm not even sure aware of her travel plans coming back through the United States, if she is or not. I don't have the information on that. Okay, final question. Yeah.
Alice Wells has been meeting with the Taliban. Can you tell us what the status of her talks? Supposedly those are the favorable Taliban, not the bad actors.
So I would take issue with the premise of your question again. I can't confirm. I can't confirm that any meetings of that nature have occurred. Alice has conversations with various government officials, and I don't have any information to provide you on any potential meetings that she has had in the future or in the past.
A year after the big strategy session on Afghanistan, can you say the situation is improved?
Look, I think
given the losses in Ghazni,
I think I addressed that. We are moving forward. The United States government continues to back the government of Afghanistan and their Afghan-led, Afghan-owned peace process. Is it going to be easy? No, certainly not. And we've seen that in the past few days, the devastating effect that bad actors can have on the peace process. But that does not mean that we are going to back away and no longer support the peace process because some factions, some people decide to terrorize the Afghan people. We are not backing away from that. We continue to support an Afghan-led, Afghan-owned peace process, and I'll leave it at that. Nothing's changed. Okay? I've got to go.
This is Weekday World from Community Public Radio, and I'm Don DeBar, your host. Up next, Wednesday's press conference at the White House with White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
I'd like to begin by reading a statement from the president. As the head of the executive branch and commander-in-chief, I have a unique constitutional responsibility to protect the nation's classified information, including by controlling access to it. Today, in fulfilling that responsibility, I've decided to revoke the security clearance of John Brennan, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Historically, former heads of intelligence and law enforcement agencies have been allowed to retain access to classified information after their government service so that they can consult with their successors regarding matters about which they may have special insights and as a professional courtesy. Neither of these justifications supports Mr. Brennan's continued access to classified information. First, at this point in my administration, any benefits that senior officials might glean from consultations with Mr. Brennan are now outweighed by the risks posed by his erratic conduct and behavior. Second, that conduct and behavior has tested and far exceeded the limits of any professional courtesy that may have been due to him. Mr. Brennan has a history that calls into question his objectivity and credibility. In 2014, for example, he denied to Congress that CIA officials under his supervision had improperly accessed the computer files of congressional staffers. He told the Council of Foreign Relations that the CIA would never do such a thing. The CIA's Inspector General, however, contradicted Mr. Brennan directly, concluding unequivocally that agency officials had indeed improperly accessed congressional staffers' files. More recently, Mr. Brennan told Congress that the intelligence community did not make use of the so-called Steele dossier in an assessment regarding the 2016 election, an assertion contradicted by at least two other senior officials in the intelligence community and all of the facts. Additionally, Mr. Brennan has recently leveraged his status as a former high-ranking official with access to highly sensitive information to make a series of unfounded and outrageous allegations, wild outbursts on the internet and television about this administration. Mr. Brennan's lying and recent conduct, characterized by increasingly frenzied commentary, is wholly inconsistent with access to the nation's most closely held secrets and facilities, the very aim of our adversaries, which is to sow division and chaos. More broadly, the issue of Mr. Brennan's security clearance raises larger questions about the practice of former officials maintaining access to our nation's most sensitive secrets long after their time in government has ended. Such access is particularly inappropriate when former officials have transitioned into highly partisan positions and seek to use real or perceived access to sensitive information to validate their political attacks. Any access granted to our nation's secrets should be in furtherance of national, not personal interest. For this reason, I've also begun to review the more general question of the access to classified information by government officials. As part of this review, I am evaluating action with respect to the following individuals: James Clapper, James Comey, Michael Hayden, Sally Yates, Susan Rice, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, and Bruce Orr. Security clearances for those who still have them may be revoked, and those who have already lost their security clearance may not be able to have it reinstated. It is for the foregoing reasons that I have exercised my constitutional authority to deny Mr. Brennan access to classified information, and I will direct appropriate staff of the National Security Council to make the necessary arrangements with the appropriate agencies to implement this determination. With that, I'll take your question. Jonathan.
Sarah, first, I've got a question I wanted to ask you, but first, just to follow up on that, it seems like everybody that you mentioned has been a political critic of the president. Is he going after his political opponents with this?
No, if there were others that weren't, that we deemed necessary, we would certainly take a look and review those as well.
Okay, I want to ask you about something the president's attorney said. Rudy Giuliani said of the special counsel Robert Mueller needs to write the damn report so we can see it and rebut it. And he said if it's not written within the next 2 or 3 weeks, quote, we will just unload on him like a ton of bricks. Is the president okay with his attorney threatening the special counsel in this way?
Certainly, we've made clear we'd like to see this wrap up. For questions specific about comments by Mr. Giuliani, I'd refer you back to him.
Was that authorized by the president?
Once again, for questions specific about the investigation, particularly comments from Rudy Giuliani, I'd refer you back to him to address those. Jeff?
Hey, Sarah. Following up on John's question, how is this announcement by the president, how can Americans not interpret that as a getting back against his critics? And isn't it also an attempt to curtail their freedom of speech by penalizing them for being critical on television?
Not at all. The president has a constitutional responsibility to protect classified information and who has access to it. And that's what he's doing, is fulfilling that responsibility in this action.
This is
action only specific to Mr. Brennan, and the others are currently under review.
Is this the kind of precedent he wants to set for future presidents when his administration is out of office, and why are there no Republicans on that list?
Once again, if we deemed it necessarily, we would certainly look into that and be happy to review those. Justin?
I wanted to ask about Turkey, but just to buttonhole on what Jeff said, I guess the reason people would say that this argument strains credibility is there's obvious examples, even from this administration. Your former national security advisor has admitted to lying to the FBI. Why is this only a list of Democrats who have been critical of the administration? And why should Americans have confidence that you are taking this seriously if there's not a single Republican on that list?
Again, certainly we would look at those if we deemed it necessary. And we'll keep you posted if that list gets updated.
So on Turkey, Turkey announced today that they're going to slap tariffs on about $1 billion of American goods. So I'm wondering if you have a response to that, and if there's any discussion internally about retaliating towards that, continuing to escalate this.
Yeah, the tariffs from Turkey are certainly regrettable and a step in the wrong direction. The tariffs that the United States placed on Turkey were out of national security interest. Theirs are out of retaliation. I'm not going to get ahead of anything on what we may or may not do in an effort to respond, but certainly we don't support Turkey's decision to retaliate against us protecting our national security interest.
An appeals court in Turkey today denied Pastor Brunson's appeal to try to be released. Does the administration view that as a new setback or as sort of a maintaining the status quo?
We feel that Turkey and specifically President Erdogan have treated Pastor Brunson, who we know to be a very good person and a strong Christian who's done nothing wrong, very unfairly, very badly, and it's something that we won't forget in the administration. Let's move on. Jake, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. So the administration has put up a robust defense of Pastor Brunson, but at the same time, there are tens of thousands of Christians in North Korea who have been imprisoned almost exclusively because of their religion. Open Door USA considered North Korea to be the number one country when it comes to persecution of the Christians. Is this something that the administration has also been looking into?
Certainly, we would like to see any individual persecuted for their Christian beliefs or imprisoned, released. Again, we've been working with North Korea on a number of fronts. That's something we'd certainly like to see them change their behavior. I know it's been discussed, and again, certainly something we'd like to see their behavior change. Sorry, Jake, I got to keep.
Just to follow up.
Go ahead.
Here's my question. Although territory held by ISIS has been reduced by over 90%, a recent UN report suggests that as many as 30,000 ISIS members still exist in Iraq and Syria. So, first of all, what's the administration's take on this specific UN report? And secondly, what would the administration consider an overall victory against ISIS?
We'd like to see every single member of ISIS defeated across the globe. I think that would be the ultimate victory. John, go ahead.
Thanks a lot, Sarah. Closing arguments are taking place across the river in Alexandria for the tax fraud trial of Paul Manafort. And in mid-June, the president said that he felt badly for Mr. Manafort and that he believes he's being treated unfairly. Is the president still friends with Mr. Manafort? When was the last time you spoke with Mr. Manafort?
I'm not aware of any recent conversations that they've had. Blake?
Do you believe he's being treated unfairly?
I think that the president's made that clear in his previous comments. I don't have anything to add beyond that at this point. Blake, go ahead.
Sarah, thank you. You just said a couple minutes ago that the increased tariff levels with Turkey were out of the national security interest. But when the president announced it on Twitter last week or earlier this month, he said, quote, at the time, he said, our relations with Turkey are not good at this time. The suggestion there being that this has to do with the pastor that is being held in Turkey. Simply put, if Pastor Brunson is allowed to leave Turkey, do those tariff levels go away? Is that kind of the deal that could be in place?
No,
is that a deal that could be on the table?
The tariffs that are in place on steel would not be removed with the release of Pastor Brunson. The tariffs are specific to national security. The sanctions, however, that have been placed on Turkey are specific to Pastor Brunson and others that we feel are being held unfairly, and we would consider that at that point.
What, in the interest of national security, what's changed over the last month or so with Turkey that you're justifying national security?
Again, the president's been clear about the steel and aluminum industries, steel particularly in this case, that those are industries that must be protected. We must have the ability to reach certain levels of manufacturing of those products here in the United States for the purposes of national security. John?
Thank you, Sarah. I was going to ask about Turkey, but based on your opening statement, I have to point out that the attorneys for former Director Comey and former Deputy Director McCabe say that their passes were automatically demagnetized the day that they were separated from their offices. Two others, Mr. Clapper and General Hayden, have said they do not use the pass at all. And also, it's my understanding from an historical standpoint, this would be the first time the president himself remove the passes from anybody, that has normally been done by agency heads or immediate superiors to people. Have you considered all these things in the process you say you're going to prove?
Again, the other individuals, those are being reviewed, and that determination will be made at a later date. Those that have already been revoked, it would be for the purpose of reviewing whether or not they should be reinstated or not. Major.
Just so I understand the standard that the president is applying, you outlined two areas of either contradictory or erroneous testimony from Brennan. Is that the only standard by which this administration is asserting he should have his security clearance revoked?
Again, I laid out the reasons in the opening statement,
right,
specific to Director Brennan.
Right.
The others are currently under review. Don't have any specifics
so
on this at this
is,
point.
Is that the standard? If you give erroneous testimony, you say something you have to correct at a certain date in the future. If you work for this administration, for example, does that mean you could lose your security clearance?
My understanding is this is being looked at on a case-by-case basis, which is why each individual is being reviewed and determination made at that point.
Does this administration have any reason to believe or evidence to suggest Brennan has misused classified information or monetized his access to it, as was alleged earlier by this administration?
Again, I've laid out the reasons for the decision that was made on this specific instance. We'll continue to review the other actions.
Can we assume by the absence of you not saying those things, you didn't find any evidence of that?
No, I wouldn't make any assumptions. I'm telling you what the decision was based off on in this case. Andrew.
Thank you very much. I wanted to follow up on a question yesterday about Afghanistan. Today there was another suicide attack in Kabul which killed 37 people in a school. A military base in the north has been overrun by the Taliban. They have also seized parts of an eastern provincial capital. Why do you think President Trump's strategy in Afghanistan is working?
As always, we're going to continue to review and look at the best ways to move forward. I'll leave it to the Department of Defense to get into specifics about tactical situations on the ground. What I can tell you is that we're committed to finding a political solution to end the conflict in Afghanistan. We're exploring all avenues for dialogue and close coordination with the Afghan government. We're going to continue to do that. If we have announcements or changes in the policy, we'll certainly let you know. Peter?
Follow up on the Turkey question, if I may. Have you guys assessed whether the liquidity situation in Turkey's financial sector is a risk in light of the fall of the lira? It's fallen like a quarter in the last 3 or 4 days.
Certainly, we're monitoring the situation with respect to the Turkish economy and the decline of the lira, but Turkey's economic problems, those are part of a long-term trend, something of its own making and not the result of any actions the United States has taken.
Thank you, Sarah. One of the individuals that you listed on that list of clearance that is under review is Bruce Ord. He's a current employee of the Department of Justice. So instead of putting him under the review, is the president believe he should be fired?
I don't have any personnel announcements on that front. I can only speak to this specific case.
Why is put a security clearance under review, which would render him unable to do his job and not just fire him?
Once again, I don't have any personnel announcements on that front. I can just tell you we're looking into that specific matter. Peter, sorry, I called on you earlier.
Thank you, Sarah. If people who criticize the president publicly on TV were public in their criticisms, are there greater risk of losing their security clearances than people who stay silent?
Once again, this is looked at on a case-by-case basis, and we'll do an individual review and make that determination. Kevin?
Thank you, Sarah. A question about the return of lawmakers on Capitol Hill, and then a follow-up very quickly. Now that they're back, can you sort of lay out the White House strategy for moving forward with this agenda? We've talked about wall funding. Obviously, a lot of people are very curious about the Kavanaugh nomination moving forward, DACA and other issues. Is there a strategy in place to begin the work with lawmakers now that they're back?
Certainly. We have continued ongoing conversations on a number of fronts with lawmakers, even while they were not here in Washington. We are happy that the hearing dates have been set for Justice Kavanaugh, and we look forward to seeing him get confirmed.
My very quick follow-up was, first of all, you didn't mention anything about a possible shutdown. Is that still something that the president is continuing? And my follow-up was going to be on the farm bill. There are a great number of people and a great number of states that are curious about this work requirement the USDA is trying to implement. In some places, they already have it. They say you have to work. In other areas, you don't have that requirement. Is that something the White House still supports?
Something we still support in terms of a shutdown. I don't have any announcements on that front. We certainly still want to see a lot of things happen. We'd love for Congress to actually do its job, particularly when it comes to immigration. We have a completely broken system, and we'd like to see them work with us to fix it. Catherine?
Thank you, Sarah.
I don't have any updates for you on that front right now. Okay. Catherine?
Omarosa Manigault Newman was the highest-ranking African-American staffer in the West Wing.
She actually didn't work in the West Wing, but go ahead.
No staffer has been appointed at that level since her absence. Can you tell us exactly how many African-American staffers there are in this building? And is it a priority for the administration to reflect the diversity of the country?
Certainly, as I addressed yesterday, we value diversity, not just at the White House, but throughout the entire administration. And we're going to continue trying to diversify the staff. We have a large number of diverse staffers from various backgrounds, both race, religion, gender.
How many staffers are there in this building?
Look, I'm not going to go through and do a count. The same way I'm not going to do a sit-down and count on the staffers that are in your news organizations.
13% of the country is African-American.
And we would love to diversify our staff and continue to do so. We do think it's important. We're going to continue to work to make that happen. Raquel?
Sarah, thank you very much. About the election last night, we are seeing the Democrats embracing a more diversity, choosing Muslims, also candidates, transgender candidates, rejecting president's agenda. So my question is, what do you think will be the impact of his agenda and also these recent controversies about race and minorities on the election in November.
Again, I think people are looking at the policies that the individuals are implementing and how those are going to affect those communities and whether or not it's actually going to help individuals, people across this country. That's what we're looking at. That's what we're focused on. That's what we're going to continue to do. I'm going to take one last question. Sarah. Amen.
Sarah. Thanks, Sarah. I'd like to ask you a couple questions about the president's recent comments, if I could. One is on Harley-Davidson. The president commented earlier in the week, many Harley-Davidson owners plan to boycott the company if manufacturing moves overseas. Great. Is the president of the United States endorsing a boycott of an iconic American company here?
Look, the president has made his feelings on that very clear. The president's focus is on making sure that we get good trade deals and that we keep business and industry here in the United States.
See a boycott of Harley, though?
I think he'd rather see them put all their companies back here in the United States and build all of their great machines here in this country. Thanks so much, guys.
We're coming into the closing months of the 17th year of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. And we have this report from RT about a suicide bombing that took 48 lives.
67 others were injured in the attack on an education center in a Shiite neighborhood of Kabul. No one has yet claimed responsibility. This comes after reports of at least 45 security personnel being killed after the Taliban attacked a military camp north of Kabul. Local journalist Sultan Faizi reports.
It has been a very deadly day for Afghanistan. It's a very bloody day for Afghanistan, not only in northern Afghanistan, but also in eastern Afghanistan. At least 12 ANA soldiers have been killed and three are missing. But in Baghlan province, specifically in the location where there are conflicting reports that all 45 people or Afghan security forces have been killed. But speaking earlier to a spokesperson for the Northern Corps, he didn't confirm the death of the ANA soldiers. He said that 28 soldiers were there and they are missing. Then they have lost connection and they tried to send reinforcement, but they have been also ambushed. Many people have been questioning the management of the security forces, that what have been they doing. So basically following post 2014, they have been only involved, the coalition forces are only involved in training, assist and advice mission. Basically they are not on the ground, but they have been conducting airstrikes that have been causing sometimes civilian casualties.
This is the latest in a string of Taliban attacks. Heavy clashes between the militant group and the country's security forces erupted last week.
I saw my friend dying. He was among 13 people, including children and women, who were killed during an airstrike last night.
There is no attention from the government and no facilities for the residents. Dead bodies are still on the roadsides. I've also been injured.
Joining me live now to discuss this further is Jamal Wakim, Professor of History and International Relations at the Lebanese University in Beirut. Good to have you with us, Mr. Wakim. Now, according to different sources, the Taliban now controls from between 14% to about 50% of Afghan territory. Given that it controlled only 1% as a result of the US invasion in 2001, what has gone wrong here?
Well, I believe that it was mainly the efforts of the United States to antagonize countries that are neighboring to Afghanistan, like China, Russia, and Iran, in addition to its role to destabilize the regime or to destabilize Pakistan, that have enabled the Taliban to maneuver win a wide space of maneuverability, especially that back in 2001-2002, the United States was only capable of pacifying the country through the logistical and intelligence provided to it by these neighboring countries to Afghanistan in an attempt to fight terrorism. So now that the United States is antagonizing all these countries, in addition to its withdrawing economic support to the Afghani government, due to austerity measures in the United States, I believe that this have given the opportunity to the Taliban to strike back and to take control of wide areas of Afghanistan.
We're seeing some critics draw parallels between Afghanistan and the now infamous U.S. campaign in Vietnam. Is that something you would agree with? Do you see it too?
Well, this is a comparison to be drawn, but I would also compare the crisis that is facing the United States in Afghanistan now to that to the crisis that faced the Soviet Union before the United States back in the 1980s, and even before that, the crisis that have faced the British attempts to pacify the country and control it back in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So I believe that Afghanistan have been the graveyard of big empires, and it might be also the graveyard of the American empire, because I don't believe or I don't see any prospect of success for the Americans in that country.
Mr. Rakim, is it the case that the longer the war drags on, the better it becomes for the Taliban?
Definitely, because the United States is being involved in too many crises. Its resources are being drained, and at the same time, it's antagonizing Russia, China, Iran, even Pakistan, India, and other countries in its attempt to maintain its hegemony over global affairs. But this is exhausting the United States, and I believe that it's leading it to overextension the way that was stated by the historian Paul Kennedy in his famous book, The Rise and Fall of Great Empires. So I believe that the United States is being overstretched, and it might lead to a big crisis within this country and, of course, its role worldwide.
What eventual outcome do you think we can expect from this long, drawn-out conflict?
Well, I believe that this will lead to further chaos in Afghanistan. At the same time, we don't see a willingness of the United States to cooperate with Iran, Russia, or China, which might makes the situation even worse. And at a time when instability is rampant in Pakistan itself due to the political crisis, this will further deteriorate into a complete chaos in the country, in Afghanistan.
Professor of History and International Relations at the Lebanese University in Beirut, Jamal Wakim, thank you for your time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.